Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
I know you told your friend you're not okay. And tell me what's wrong and why you never said you felt that way. And guess you're trying to stay strong and fake a smile until I look away. But I've known you too long, it hurts to watch your blue eyes fade to gray as you fade away.
I feel like I haven't done a hometown case in a while. I've been waiting for some more recent cases in Calgary to move through the court system, and justice moves very slowly around these parts, and also information gets hard to track down until well after the fact. And I was hoping to have some sentencing documents or appeals or something on today's case, but it's a little bit too recent for that. But I'm going to tell Vanessa Lattiker's case because she deserves a voice. And I'm sure most of you have never heard of Vanessa until today. But first of all, I probably don't have to tell you this, but I am not an expert on much of anything. If my bad pronunciations didn't give that away. I'm not a psychiatrist or a lawyer or a forensic expert. I'm not even in law enforcement, nothing like that. But I do really like to learn things. Like, I'm interested in a lot of stuff. And when I try to learn something, I try to do it from credible sources. Like, I do Google stuff, but I do try to inject some common sense into it. I don't spend a lot of time on blogs or WebMD. But in the end, I am just an accountant with a podcast. So take what I say with whatever you think it's worth here. And a disclaimer that I'm starting today's episode with a topic that actually has nothing to do with today's case, but you'll see why I bring it up a little bit later. You have to trust me, it will all come together here. Just settle down. And that topic is schizophrenia. Yes, that dreaded word that probably 75% of criminals who commit violent crimes try to use as an excuse for their behavior. And schizophrenia is an actual legitimate diagnosis, but let's sort of talk about it and how it relates to NCR, or not criminally responsible, otherwise known as insanity defenses. Now, the DSM-5 goes into great detail about diagnosing schizophrenia, that the person has to have two or more of the following things the majority of the time for a period of at least 30 days. But they go into a lot of detail about some other things that have to be ruled out first and a lot of blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm not trying to learn how to be a psychiatrist. I actually have a person's story to get to that I really want to honor. So I am taking the majority of the criteria for diagnosis from the Mayo Clinic, who kind of summarizes a little bit better for us. Number one is delusions, which are different from hallucinations. It is simply a belief that something is true or real that isn't. So, like a paranoid feeling that your coworker is plotting to get you fired when in reality they're just eating a turkey sandwich. That could be an example of a delusion. But a better example is like someone who believes that the government is tapping their phone. Like, that is a delusion. Or that drinking wine is considered a serving of fruit. We can all be delusional at times. But if you are consistently delusional about something, then that is not a good sign. Hallucinations are actually hearing or seeing things that are not there. And these appear really very real to the person. So it's not easy to talk them into like they're just seeing or hearing things. Like their brain is actually playing tricks on them. And I imagine that is a very scary symptom for someone. So I think we need a little bit of compassion there. That would be no fun at all, regardless of what the voices are telling you to do or not do. Disorganized speech and thought. So people with schizophrenia tend to kind of ramble or maybe answer questions that weren't what was asked. Now, very rarely do they just put together a bunch of random words like word salad. It's just what they're talking about isn't maybe in logical order or doesn't make a lot of sense to someone. Now, people with ADHD and anxiety issues can kind of ramble too, but this would sound a little bit more concerning. Like instead of just kind of wishing that they'd get back on subject, you would be thinking like, what are you talking about? They can be extremely disorganized, and I do not mean like a messy room or like the school binder with paper sticking out of it all over, but like behavior that doesn't seem to have a goal. Like, you know how when you pull your laundry out of the dryer? No. Listen, whether you fold your laundry or not is not my business. I'm not judging. I'm just saying that the goal is likely to be to fold it like one piece at a time, with the ultimate goal of placing it in a laundry bin to take that bin into the next room or whatever you do with it. And sometimes you can get distracted in that goal, right? The cat vomits or you overhear your five-year-old starting the car in the garage or something like that. Well, with someone with schizophrenia, they might not fold the laundry at all. Like maybe they'll take one article out and then put it somewhere that doesn't make sense and then move on to something else entirely. It's not about being distracted or messy. It's about not moving or behaving in a way that makes logical sense. And then lastly, there are behavioral changes, such as no longer making eye contact, or they stop their daily hygiene, or they just kind of sound very flat when they talk, which can, of course, mimic some other symptoms of some other mental health issues. So all of this brings me to schizophrenia when it comes to violent behavior. It's probably not a surprise to you that schizophrenia is highly stigmatized as a mental health diagnosis, which probably generally has to do with people claiming that the voices made them do it when they get caught committing a crime than it does with any actual facts about it. Well, only about 1% of the entire global population actually has schizophrenia, which is still 3.2 million Americans. And most of those people are diagnosed between 16 and 25 years old. Now, sadly, schizophrenia reduces a person's lifespan by about 28.5 years. Now that's globally, and generally because the risk of suicide is a lot higher for them than any other group, but also because in many countries there is not a lot of treatment options and the stigma, of course. Like if you think the stigma is bad around these parts, well. And speaking of stigma, despite a lot of common fears when hearing the word schizophrenia, people with the diagnosis are actually far more likely to either be a danger to themselves or become victims of other people than to victimize another person. But of course, the fear persists. When people think of schizophrenia, they of course think of the words psychotic or psychosis, which are not actual diagnoses, but rather symptoms. And it just means losing touch with reality and can be caused by, yes, schizophrenia, but also by substance abuse, sleep disturbances, or even things like Parkinson's or epilepsy. It can also be temporary, whereas schizophrenia is a chronic illness, but not necessarily do schizophrenics remain in a constant state of psychosis, if that makes sense. And all of this is different than the word psychopath or psychopathy. being a psychopath is not a mental health condition. It's generally like being an asshole as a personality. You will not find it in the DSM-5. Well, it used to be, but it used to be called antisocial personality. Now it simply refers to a neurodevelopment disorder that makes it difficult for someone to feel empathy. It is characterized by reduced empathy and remorse, daring or reckless behaviors, a lack of inhibition, and aggressive or violent behaviors, although that last one isn't always a given. There are layers to it, and some feel psychopathy is more like a spectrum. But despite some negative myths about schizophrenia, there are some alarming statistics about it. And that is that a person with schizophrenia is about 4 to 6 times more likely to commit a violent offense than, say, the average person. 6% of homicides are committed by people with schizophrenia, but to put that into perspective, that means that 94% of homicides are committed by just plain assholes. Probably by psychopaths, but don't take that as fact. I'm just making that up. However, unlike the average asshole, there are some warning signs in people with schizophrenia that can indicate that a person is leaning towards maybe becoming violent. Very rarely do they just kind of spin out of control on a whim. They may start by talking a little bit more about violence or anger against, say, a certain person or like a group of people. They start writing or drawing about violence and death and start to behave in just kind of slightly more aggressive ways than they normally would, and also start trying to maybe get their hands on some weapons. Not necessarily guns, but they could be like hiding knives or something like that. And there's just a general increase in their paranoia. Now, here is something that should probably get your attention. Just as in the neurotypical population, self-medicating schizophrenia with drugs and alcohol can and often does lead to violence. And of course, the biggest culprits of that being cocaine and methamphetamines. But also in people that are prone to psychosis, weed is a big one. So although we like to think of marijuana as pretty harmless, it can be problematic, let's say, in certain populations. Anyways, under the law, if a person with schizophrenia commits a violent offense, say murder, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card automatically. Like, you have to prove that at the moment the crime was committed, you were in a state of psychosis, so out of touch with reality, and that being out of touch with reality was not induced by illicit drugs or alcohol. Like, you can't claim that you're a schizophrenic and you didn't know what you were doing if you were also taking methamphetamines. Juries do not like those chicken and the egg things and will likely not rule in your favor. So you have to have been sick enough, and again, this is at the actual time of the crime, to have either not understood the consequences of your actions or the actions themselves, like the wrongfulness of them. Like, it's like the Vince Lee case, believing fully that he was slaying a dragon and not beheading an actual person. So generally speaking, when someone is in a state of psychosis, like a true state of psychosis and not like a made up one, they don't make moves to cover up or clean up crime scenes. They don't hide their weapons, lie about their whereabouts, or say take out life insurance policies on people. And they may not remember committing the actual crime, but they don't try to hide it, if that makes sense. Like, remember, their thinking and their behaviors are not, like, they're disordered. So they're not goal oriented, regardless of whether they're having hallucinations or not. Okay, so now that I have taken up 15 minutes of your time with stuff that has nothing to do with today's case, let's get started on what we all came here for. And these were just my highly summarized bullet points on this stuff. Remember, just an accountant with a podcast and kind of a big mouth about the asshats of the world. This is the murder of Vanessa Lattiker.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty. Does that include the time I stole a comic book when I was 5 years old?
Let the court stand for itself.
Vanessa Lattiker was born June 4th, 1991, to her mom, Erica, and her dad, who I believe was named Leon, but I could be wrong about that. She had a sister named Renee, with whom she was very close, and Erica raised both Renee and Vanessa as a single mom. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a lot of details about her childhood or where she grew up, but I do know that she grew into a lovely woman that was working really hard at fulfilling her dreams, and that her mom, Erica, had often worked two jobs to give them the life that she felt that they really deserved, never kind of going without anything. The three of them were kind of like the Three Musketeers. They went camping, hiking, they went to galleries together. And Vanessa was a bit of a fitness junkie, which of course led to her having a very toned and healthy figure. And she took very good care of herself physically, which of course resulted in this effortless beauty that she had. But she wasn't just beautiful on the outside. She was on the inside as well. Like, her family described her as ridiculously funny and just very caring and loving and very kind. And this kindness was something that just made her more lovely than even her locks of blonde hair that was always very well styled. Like, she genuinely cared about people, and particularly people that were experiencing hardships. Erica had told Brittany Gervais of the Calgary Herald in 2022 that Vanessa had a soft spot in her heart for people that were living homeless in our city's downtown core, and her mom had volunteered at different homeless shelters in the city. She would give someone a sandwich, and she bought mittens when it was cold, and she would hang the mittens along the trees along 17th Avenue for people to just kind of grab if they needed them. And she had gotten to know a few people that were living rough, and she would refer to them by name. She would buy them coffee and just be really, really kind and compassionate to them. Her mom says that on one Thanksgiving, she actually used her own money, which she didn't have a lot of, to buy one particular person a meal and some socks and some gloves for them because it was getting cold. She read a lot. She was interested in a wide variety of topics, from different religions to politics. And she was a particular fan of the writings of the humanitarian Maya Angelou and Martin Luther King Jr. She was also very into fitness, as I said, and she was training with a boxer to do an Ironman competition. So she had put actually her love of fitness into her career and was working as a personal trainer at Heaven Fitness in the Palliser South High Rise, which was just a few blocks from her apartment downtown. And before that, she had actually worked at a spin cycle studio. And if you've ever taken a spin class, you know that, well, for one thing, it's very good cardio. But the instructors they're always really outgoing, and I think they make it a lot of fun. And that was the kind of person that was just fun and just a very kind soul. Early in the morning of March 18th, 2022, Vanessa's world would collide with a man named Michael Adetti. Michael was about the same age as Vanessa, and I don't know much about him or his childhood and family either. But that March, he was 26 years old, and Vanessa was 30, just about to turn 31. Michael was also outgoing and into fitness. He played basketball and he did some boxing. I'm not sure what he did for a living, but he had a YouTube channel that he was working on growing under the name of Michael Adetti 412. Now, his description read, "On the rise, support your man, future boxing champion, road to 1 million followers, reactions, skits, sports, and all things anime." Now, I don't know about getting to a million followers, but he has just over 1,100 after 7 years on YouTube. His first post was on February 26, 2018. He was just kind of showing off some dance moves. It got only 94 views, but Specific Potato 9024 commented that he or she was a big fan. Most of the videos are anime and other reviews and like reactions to things. It was the early days of YouTube, so the quality isn't great, but he comes off as quite knowledgeable about his topics of choice. Now, his videos on TikTok, I guess, have been more successful. He's got about 40,000 subscribers there. I don't know if that's good or not. I have kind of avoided TikTok, but it sounds moderately successful. In October of 2018, he posted a video about tips on being successful in life called Inspiration 5 Keys for Success in Life.
Hey guys, I wanted to talk to you about 5 key things that have helped me change my life into excel. And these are 5 important keys that people don't tell you in high school that you really need to know. CCPMF. Change, choice, passion, mistakes, forgiveness. Now, change is constant. It's the one thing that you can always count on to be there. Change. It's going to happen regardless, whether you want it to or not. So you really have to decide who you want to be 6, 5, 3 months from now. You know, it's up to you. You know, you can stay in the same horrible circle of friends that you have. You can stay fat, not work out. You can not go to class, ditch. But that's going to, it's going to affect you because you're not always going to have that opportunity, you know, because really change is a lack and gain of opportunities, you know, but your opportunities they depend on you. Okay, that's one thing. Choice is the next. You have a choice that goes with change. Like I said, opportunities are created by you and your choices. Everything is dependent on a choice. You can decide who you want to be in life through choosing. Just make a choice. Choose. I want to be fit. Okay. Then take steps to be fit. Eat better. Work out. Drink more water. Speak positive. You know, watch workout videos. I don't know. Okay. I don't know. But that's what you need to do in that field, in those range of things. You make a choice and you stick to it. Okay. You want to be a good computer scientist. You want to be good at math. You got to study. You got to practice. You got to code. You know, you got to make a choice. Third is passion. One of the things that people don't understand is that passion is not something you find. It's something you create. You have to create passion. When people tell you, oh, just, you know, go to school and you'll figure out your passion. Don't worry about being confused right now. You'll get it. It's not really like that. You need to really take the time to get to know yourself and then get to the grind, you know, because the hard reality in life is there are winners and there are losers. There are losers and winners, no matter what. That's something they don't tell you in high school. You'll find out in college, even in some colleges, a lot of colleges, they won't tell you. There are losers and winners in life. Unfortunately, there are people who are going to be working shitty jobs, working for other people, working a 9 to 7, even though they don't want to. But it's a part of life. You know, you have to really get to know yourself, work hard, decide you want it, and then work towards it. You create your passion. You know, Steve Jobs didn't just wake up and, hey, I got the iPhone. You know, he had to go on a spiritual journey to find himself. And then he worked at trying to create this thing that was in his head in reality. I mean, it was difficult and it probably wasn't fun all the time, you know, but the fun comes once it becomes a passion, but it becomes a passion when you make it one. So you have to work towards it. You know, LeBron James didn't just wake up a great basketball player. He worked towards it. You know, that's something you have to work towards. Floyd Mayweather, greatest boxer of all time. My opinion, my favorite boxer. He puts in more work than anybody. And you see the result. You see the result. I don't know if you've ever been boxing, but it's difficult. It's a difficult thing. I'm a boxer myself, so I know. I'm not a professional, amateur, but I box. It's a very difficult thing. And at times it cannot be fun, you know, but I can tell you for sure, in the beginning it was a lot harder than it is now. It is a passion of mine now because I made it so. Okay. The next is mistakes. You know, it's okay to make mistakes in life. You're going to make mistakes. Don't stay in the past. Don't stick to the past. Move forward because mistakes just keep you in a cycle. just in a cycle. Don't live in the past. You make mistakes, learn from them. Mistakes are there to seek failure, because failure actually, it shows you what's right and what's wrong. You know, it gives you a clear idea of things you need to work on and things that aren't working. So it's actually pretty good, you know. It's not, you know, it doesn't kill you to make mistakes, you know. A pluses and Bs in classes don't really matter in the real world. They don't decide who you are or where you're going to go. I know a lot of people who got multiple A's but ended up flunking high school, flunking college, you know. Straight A students went straight to college and didn't want to do it anymore. Quit it to go become artists or musicians or stuff like that, you know. It's the reality, you know. You're going to make a mistake. It's going to happen. Accept it, but understand that it's not the end of the world. Last one, and the most important one, I believe, is forgiveness. You're going to go through a lot of hard things in your life. You're going to be a lot of people who are going to talk bad about you, maybe even break your heart, leave you, divorce you, steal from you, make fun of you, talk about you. But
this isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Just realize that you have to forgive all that. You can't allow people to keep you down, you know, because the only person who can keep you down is you. Forgiveness is a way to let go and to move forward. You know, that goes with choice as well. You're making a choice to forgive somebody, so you leave that cycle of constant hatred and confusion. You know, forgiveness, forgive. When you don't forgive somebody, you keep yourself in the past and you keep yourself in that situation, in that mindset of pain. That's why God says to forgive, you know. He says things in simple ways. God says things in simple ways, but such a big masterpiece behind what he's trying to give you. He's telling you to forgive because it's a way to let go. Take a deep breath, motherfucker. Take a deep breath. It's okay. Forgive, and you'll be good. That issue, that person, they cannot keep you down. They cannot stop you from reaching your potential. Only you can. Forgive them. Move on. It's okay, baby. You do you. We do you, boo-boo. I'm going to go ahead and do me and be all right? So remember, change, choice, passion, mistakes, forgiveness. 5 keys from Michael Aden.
And just 2 weeks before his world collided with Vanessa, he posted this video teaching the historical inspirations behind some popular anime characters called demigods in One Piece?
One Piece theories part 36. What if I told you that every single straw hat represents a mythological character? Starting with the pirate hunter Zoro, I want you to take notice of his multiple hands, multiple swords, and multiple heads. Pay attention to that. That's because Zoro's character is inspired by people like this, a demigod named Ashura from the Hinduism religion. Next, we have everyone's favorite pirate, Monkey D. Luffy, but the secret and hint are in his name. Luffy is inspired by Wukong, or Sun Wukong. Kind of reminds you of Sun God Nico, right? Next we have Frankie. If you didn't know, Frankie's inspired by Frankenstein. Guess that Tony Chopper is inspired by the Abominable Snowman. Last but not least, we have Mr. King of Snipers, Usopp. I'll give you a hint. His inspiration is kind of a trickster, kind of like him. And his inspiration is Loki. They're both tricksters, kind of deceivers, but they both have a lot of raw power.
which he posted on March 2nd. Shadow Pulse Feed, which is another YouTube channel, notes that in his videos, he appears to have lower cognitive function and is kind of immature for his age. But I don't really feel that, but you can decide that for yourself. That morning, Michael left his apartment building taking his bike with him and his backpack. Now he leaves the building. He's kind of having some issues maneuvering his bike through the double set of glass doors of his high-rise building. This was at 6:30 in the morning. He's wearing a gray hoodie and jeans with white sneakers and just kind of appears to be on his way to either work or school. Vanessa leaves her building at around the same time, and she's just about a block or so away from Michael's building. Moments later, she's seen walking past a bar called Bottle Screw Bill's at 140 10th Avenue Southwest. She is wearing all black. She's also carrying a backpack. She passes Michael on his bike. Now, I'm not sure if he was riding in the opposite direction or if he was like taking a break and just like leaning on his bike and standing next to it. I can't really see that on the surveillance footage that was released, but all the reports that I've read say that he was on his bike, which would make sense seeing that he took his bike with him. But at some point he gets off of the bike or leaves the bike behind, like leaves it parked somewhere. Footage from a few seconds after this sort of chance passing on the sidewalk, Vanessa's continuing to walk towards the Palliser South building down 10th Avenue, and Michael's about a block behind her, but he's walking rather quickly, so he's gaining some ground on her. At 6:39, she starts to walk past the opening of like a parking garage, so it's kind of like an alleyway, but it leads into this like parking lot underground. Michael is now like kind of jogging and he's just seconds behind her and he appears that he's going to pass her on the right. But he also has this kind of dark object in his hand. And just as like a truck passes them on the road beside the sidewalk where they both are, he body checks her and sends her to the ground in this alcove or kind of an opening between two buildings. Once on the ground, he stabbed Vanessa 8 times with a knife, which they believe was the object that he had been carrying, and was initially packed in his bag. 6 of those stab wounds were to Vanessa's face, fracturing her jaw and cheekbone. And then one of the wounds was to her chest, which created a large amount of blood loss. A witness that was in a building nearby heard Vanessa's screams and he had ran to his window and saw what was happening. And he yelled at Michael to stop what he was doing. So then Michael then ran away just as a security officer from the parking garage where this alcove was ran towards her to help. Vanessa had actually managed to get herself up off the ground and had stumbled to like kind of a lobby of a building. The witness and the security guard reached her at kind of the same time. They were both calling 911 and they started putting pressure on her chest wound. The security guard held her hand, told her that it was going to be okay. You know, help was on the way, just hang in there. But she did slip out of consciousness. The paramedics arrived and, of course, rushed her to the Foothills Hospital where she was pronounced dead on arrival. Now, a police officer had traveled in the ambulance with Vanessa, and when they arrived, he was told by one of the nurses that this man had just come in. He had some cuts on his hands and he had said they had been from falling off of his skateboard and onto some glass. And that didn't make sense to her. That man, of course, was Michael Addetti, who was arrested and then taken in for questioning right then and there. Now, Michael denied having killed Vanessa and said that when the knife had actually been found in the parkade where Vanessa had been attacked was tested for DNA, he said his DNA would not be on it.
Are we going to find Vanessa's DNA on your shoes?
No, the pants.
No.
You sure about that?
Yeah.
However, of course, tests came back that both Vanessa and Michael's blood was on that knife. Also on surveillance footage at 6:41, Michael runs to the back of the Ramada Hotel in this alleyway where there's a big blue dumpster bin. He's wearing his black gloves. He lifts the dumpster lid while kind of looking around nervously and discards this folding knife and his backpack. He then heads westbound down the end of the alley. When shown the surveillance footage, Michael then, of course, changed his tune, said that, well, actually, I see demons and I was afraid for my life because she was actually this creature and it was kind of a kill or be killed in that situation. And it wasn't until he saw the cuts on his hand that he realized that he had been hallucinating. And in the process, of course, ended Vanessa's young and very promising life, and of course, destroyed the lives of Erica, Renee, and anyone whose lives had been touched by her and her kindness. So, of course, hinting that this NCR or insanity defense was coming, which is why I spent 15 minutes of your life talking about schizophrenia at the top of this episode, so that we had some context as to what that means in regards to the law. Well, just a few days later after his arrest, while sitting in the remand center, which is like our holding jail where you go if you're charged with a crime until you wait for your trial to come up, Michael was returning a board game to the cafeteria in his unit, which was Unit 10, when another inmate named Michael Elndu, who is a convicted murderer, who was just waiting to be sentenced and moved to his prison home, punched him. Now, Elndu was accompanied by his buddies, Keith Beaverbones, who was awaiting trial on 4 attempted murder charges, and Amandeep Sagu, who was awaiting trial on 2 counts of first-degree murder. Now, Michael Ndedi punched Elndu back, but was tackled to the ground before the guards had intervened. Michael walked away with a cut on the mouth and a bump in the noggin. However, I bring up this small incident because during the trial for Elndu, who was charged with assault for it, Michael was cross-examined by the lawyer for Elndu, and it was first suggested that Michael had actually been the one that had started the fight because he had been charged with killing a woman and he needed a little bit of prison credibility or something. Now, Michael, of course, denied that. But when the lawyer said that, well, you have schizophrenia, so that means that you have some problems telling real things from imaginary things. So, like, how do we know that you didn't just, like, hallucinate being attacked? And he was asked specifically, you're not able to tell when things are real or imaginary. Well, he responded with, I can tell when things are real. Well, right away when you're arrested for murder or manslaughter, one of the first orders of business is a psychological assessment to make sure that you are what they call fit to stand trial, that you understand the sort of the legal process and that there's some charges against you. It is not done automatically. Your defense lawyer usually applies for what they call a 30-day assessment, where you go to a forensic psychiatric unit to be housed for 30 days so they can get a sense of, you know, where you're at mental health-wise. But it is so commonplace that they might as well make it automatic. So that was applied for on March 31st of 2022, so within the first month after he was charged. Now, by that time, he was actually on his second lawyer, but I'm not sure why his first lawyer, Tony Rulston, requested to be off the case. It sounds like it was some kind of leave, like maybe a maternity leave or something, not because he was being difficult or anything like that. So it was Curtis Meany who requested the initial assessment on his behalf, and he then becomes his official defense attorney. And he was assessed by Dr. David Tano, who found him at the time fit to stand trial. Now, he said that he was fit because he did understand the legal process and that he had the ability to work with and give instructions to his defense attorneys. But he did point out in this particular assessment that there could be maybe room for an NCR defense because he had auditory hallucinations. So that's the hearing of voices, not the seeing things. Or at least Dr. Tano believed that he had auditory hallucinations. I would think that it would be hard to confirm or deny that since you can't really get into somebody else's head. Now, being fit to stand trial actually doesn't have that much to do with NCR defenses because it's not really any kind of diagnosis. It's just determining if the person has the ability to understand that they have been charged with a crime. So you can be completely well-adjusted and sane and still not be considered fit to stand trial, or you can be frothing at the mouth and be considered fit under the law. It's kind of a thing. I don't fully understand it all, but you get the gist of it. It's kind of a mental snapshot in time. So the assessment is about what's going on with you like right now, and an NCR defense is focused on what was going on with you at the exact moment of the crime. So by July of 2022, Curtis said that he was concerned that Michael's mental state had deteriorated while he was sitting in jail, and so he wanted another assessment done to determine if he was still fit to stand trial, which to me sounds like kind of another shot at delaying a trial is all that that was. But I was not there. It just seems odd that he was fit in mid-April, but by early July, he's in a bad way already. And that turned out to be just kind of the beginning of some trial delays. The trial was originally supposed to start in October of 2023, but this being Canada, I'm not actually surprised that it got pushed back because a defense witness wasn't going to be available for them or something. The standard here for murder trials is usually about 2 years between arrest and then the opening statements of a trial. So it really doesn't surprise me that it got pushed back. Then it was supposed to start on September 9th of 2024, but one of the defense attorneys, Kim Ross, because by this time he had two attorneys, there was Kim Ross and then Curtis Meany, he was recovering from a surgery that he had back in February of 2024, and he wouldn't be able to handle such a complex trial. So it didn't actually get started until March 31st of 2025. The justice at this September delay hearing was not really happy about adjourning it then because by that time, Michael had been in custody for 2 years and was getting close to the legal limit under Jordan's law, which states that trials have to happen within 2 years of the charges, or those charges could basically be stayed, just kind of a get off scot-free kind of thing. I think that the defense attorneys really love trial delays. That's kind of what they're always hoping for. But she granted the delay anyways because Kim Ross waived his client's right to the Jordan's law, which seems like kind of a dick move, but whatevs. It's also a dick move to delay trials for the victim's family because we tend to rearrange our schedules, plan time off work to face down our person's killer. And also because we just want information and you cannot get information until the matter goes to trial. But the trial did eventually start. Carla McPhail was the Crown prosecutor, and then both Kim Ross and Curtis Meany were the defense attorneys. I've heard of Kim Ross before. I think he's done a number of high-profile cases here in Calgary, but I have not heard Curtis's name before. And this was all presided over by Justice Jane Sidnall. Carla McPhail told the jury in her opening statement that the defense was going to claim that Michael was not criminally responsible, that he had been suffering from this psychotic break and wasn't able to understand that what he was doing was not just legally wrong, but morally wrong. But they, as the prosecutor, were going to prove that not only was he responsible, he had planned it and it was a deliberate act of first degree murder, saying, quote, he pursued her until the moment was right to attack her, end quote. That he had basically waited for a truck to pass and then pushed her out of sight, not to mention that he had packed a knife in his backpack for the purposes of killing someone, and that he had stabbed her multiple times, intentionally killing her. Now, the Crown, of course, relied on the surveillance footage that showed Michael following Vanessa for about 2 blocks and making ground on her before deliberately attacking her. And then, of course, the footage of him discarding his backpack and this knife and then fleeing the scene, which they felt was proof that he did know what he did was wrong, as well as he also lied to the nurses at the hospital about how he had gotten the cuts on his hand, and outright denying that he had killed her when he was initially questioned. So all of it, they felt, proved that Michael was in his so-called right mind and had taken steps to not just stalk his victim, but also try to cover up his tracks, and that he had purposely packed a knife in his bag that morning because he had planned to kill someone. The jury also heard from some quotes from his notebook that he kept that were found in his backpack, which had some notes in it about killing 3 people and what appeared to be kind of like a hit list of some celebrity names. But there wasn't a lot of context given about his notebooks, and so it could have been like just kind of notes on his anime that he was reviewing and doing on YouTube. But when it was time, Michael testified on his own behalf, which is a bit of a bold move for the defense. He testified that at the time he was having these hallucinations due to having schizophrenia, and that he believed that Vanessa was this creature that he had to attack or he was risk being killed himself. He said again that he only realized what he had done, that he had done that to a human being when he saw the cuts on his hand. Now, he claimed that he had actually packed the kitchen knife from his own house because he was afraid of these creatures that he had been seeing recently. His mother, Farida, also testified on his behalf, saying that he started having these hallucinations around September of 2021, where he would be seeing these frightening looking creatures and animals, and that he had started taking these hour-long showers because he wanted to drown out the voices in his head. Now, she claimed it was very real to him, that she couldn't see anything, but that he would actually at times open the window and then tell them to get out. He would say it was some kind of malevolent animal that he has never seen before and that was trying to hurt him, and they must sort of get out of his room. And they were not just regular animals. They were like bears with bald heads and big eyes. She went on to say that he was starting to wear his clothes backwards and would talk to his shoelaces.
Today, Ferit Loyak told the jury her son was scared of animal-like creatures he was seeing since 2021, would talk to his shoelaces, and wore his clothes backwards. The Crown suggested Denny's parents never revealed these details to police because the woman isn't telling the truth to help her son. His defense argues Adeniyi should not be criminally responsible by reason of mental disorder.
They had taken him to a psychiatrist in November who had given him a prescription for Prozac, but he had been diagnosed at that time with depressive disorder, which is still a serious mental health diagnosis, but it's not schizophrenia. So Carla cross-examined her and asked her why she or Michael had never said anything about these animals and creatures when he had been talking to the police or to the psychiatrist that did the assessment. And then she had answered that that's not what they were asking us about. So I guess that answers that question.
And the defense says that there is no doubt that Michael Adeniyi killed Vanessa Ladasour, but says he should be found not criminally responsible due to a mental disorder. But the Crown maintains that this killing was both planned and deliberate. Now, Adeniyi says he was hallucinating of animal-like shadows and believed he was attacking demonic creatures. The defense saying it's clear he was in the midst of a psychotic episode, citing a psychiatrist who testified during the trial that they were concerned Adeniyi suffered from an underlying psychotic illness. He was not lying to you. He was telling the truth, Kim Ross told the jury. But the Crown says that determination was based on outright untruths from both Adeni and his family. Harlow McPhail told the jury the killing was intentional. She pointed out the accused waited until cars had passed before tackling the victim out of sight into an alcove, adding he also ditched his blood-covered jacket because he knew what he was doing was wrong. Prosecutors also cite notebooks found in a backpack he dumped in an alley garbage shortly after the attack, where he had wrote things like, three people to kill. And they also pointed out his internet search history for how much blood loss can a person handle.
Now, after the defense rested, Justice Sidnall gave her instructions to the jury and told them that they would have to decide between first and second degree murder, manslaughter, or not criminally responsible, saying Mr. Adeni relies on having suffered from a mental disorder at the time of the offense that rendered him incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of the attack or of knowing that the attack on Vanessa was wrong. Mr. Andetti has the burden to prove his NCR defense. If you find that Mr. Andetti has not proven his NCR defense, then you will consider the charge that Mr. Andetti faces. There will be no more evidence. It is your duty to decide if Mr. Andetti has proven that it is more likely than not that he is not criminally responsible due to a mental disorder at the time of the crime. You must make your decision on a rational and fair consideration and not on passion, sympathy, or prejudice against Mr. Andetti. Now, in the end, the jury didn't buy his not criminally responsible claims, and rather that it had been planned and deliberate of a murder, and found him guilty of the most serious of the charges, which is first-degree murder, which comes with an automatic life sentence with no parole for at least 25 years. At his sentencing hearing, which is more of a formality for first-degree murder convictions, Erica, who's Vanessa's mom, she gave a very emotional and very well-versed victim impact statement that was directed mostly at Michael himself. And she told the court that she now suffers from complex PTSD. She has lost her job as a result of that. The PTSD was caused by being brought into the trauma bay at Foothills to identify her daughter's body. She said, quote, I remember standing there not understanding why her beautiful blonde hair was red. My brain could just not accept what I was seeing. To make it worse, I was not allowed to touch her because forensics was not finished with processing her body. The pain that I feel every day since then is immeasurable. Losing her was so profound, it's impossible to put into words. Her sister has already moved away, and I will be doing the same shortly. I cannot stay in Calgary without being reminded of her wherever I go in the city. The memories are too painful. I hope you remember her beautiful face every time you see the scars on your hands or look in the mirror, that you never get a chance to hurt someone else. The guilt that I have to overcome that I wasn't there to protect her as her mother was profound. The fact that you, Michael, just butchered her and left her there to die on the street like an animal is incomprehensible. All the dreams that I had as a mother for my child destroyed in 12 seconds. I believe that the sentence you receive for this senseless and cowardly killing is just, and hope you will never receive parole, but serve the full sentence under the law. And upon giving the sentence, Justice Sidnall referred to what Michael did as a heinous crime, that she was just on her way to work and he took her life and left her family and friends destroyed, and that she was nothing but an innocent victim. Michael Andetti will be eligible for parole in March of 2047. Now, the actual real motive, other than this Vanessa being a creature in his mind, like why he actually did it, remains a mystery. There is some speculation that Michael held some kind of incel views on women, but there really isn't any evidence of that in his videos that he's posted. It didn't come up as being like in any of the writings or drawings in his notebook. Personally, I think he just wanted to be famous. And these YouTube videos were taking too long to take off for him. I think that he got it in his head that he wanted to do it just by sort of looking over what he did post online, it seemed like being known as like the best at something was really important to him, like on his way to this million subscribers. He's got posts of him like playing basketball and doing some amateur boxing. Now he did manage to win at provincials, I guess. And just a lot of comments that it's just the beginning of his championship journey. The videos then switch to more like anime and reviews. Like it's like he's trying something, expecting it to be his new thing and he's going to be the best at it. And then he switches to something else after sort of not attaining immediate success at it, which is what leads me to think that murder was just another attempt at getting famous and trying to be the best at something. Well, you didn't, Michael. You suck. And you are, I think, just another example of an asshat that continues to give schizophrenia a bad name and, of course, the stigma for those that legitimately suffer from it and haven't killed anyone. But, of course, it makes people hear the diagnosis and are fearful of it. There was a little bit of hope that came from Vanessa's tragic murder. Erica really pushed for this task force to be set up to make living and working downtown safer for the residents and its visitors there. And this task force consulted with 40 businesses and social agencies and did come up with 28 recommendations to address the root causes of the violence that happens in the downtown core, including closing off some of the parts of the plus 15 walkways, which are, if you're not from here, they're the overhead kind of bridges that connect some of the buildings in the core, because some of those places have become overcome with some criminal activity. In March of 2024, the city of Calgary announced that the recommendations that were put forth by the Downtown Safety Leadership Table are a blueprint and a commitment for improvement. As we implement these 28 key initiatives, we are forging a future where every Calgarian can take pride in a downtown that is safe and inclusive for all. The Safety Leadership Table's collaborative effort underscores the power of convening diverse perspectives, highlighting the importance of coming together to address complex challenges. Now, steps have already been taken to some of the actions, like they've increased the uniform officer presence and some coordination, safety and some maintenance, cleanliness improvements of public spaces, and some other resource supports for those that are experiencing vulnerabilities. Quote, with council's ongoing focus and investments in community safety and well-being, administration is well positioned to work with our partners to act on the recommendations. We are committed to a Calgary where everyone feels safe, connected, supported, and that they belong. End quote. Except Michael, he does not belong. The city didn't say that. I'm just adding that part. And that was the tragic and unnecessary murder of Vanessa Latiker. I think the very randomness of Vanessa's murder is what's really frightening to me. Like, normally murderers choose someone that they know and for a reason other than just like looking for something to do. Erica had told the Calgary Herald in 2024 that now just hearing footsteps behind her can kind of set off some major anxiety for her thinking about what happened to Vanessa. And I think that that is completely frightening that someone can just like come up behind you and end your life for no reason. I did not like this story. And I will be back again with another story that I will probably not like. As always, thank you so much for listening.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.